different species of termites headbang at different rates. They hope that this discovery will be useful in trying to locate and eradicate invasive species of termites.
Oh, like those Formosan subterranean termites that are destroying so many buildings and trees in the southern U.S.
Exactly. They use special microphones to listen to the termite vibrations of nearly 2,000 trees in New Orleans. The headbanging of the invasive Formosan termites is faster and more continuous than the banging made by a less destructive native species of termite. By listening to the vibrations, the scientists were able to correctly identify trees infested with Formosan termites 97% of the time. Visual inspections only found 50% of the infested trees.
That rocks.
It sure does.
This moment of science comes from Indiana University, with production support from the Brebsen Foundation.
Today's program was prepared by Sue Ann Zollinger, with help from Armin Macek in biology. For a moment of science, I'm Yael Cassander.
And I'm Don Glass.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Sangamon Auditorium, UIS, presenting the host of This American Life, Ira Glass, in an evening entitled Radio Stories and Other Stories on Saturday, December 13th at 8 p.m. Tickets are now on sale at 217-206-6160 or online at sangamonauditorium.org.
It's 2:41. Goalie Manny Legacy of the St. Louis Blues has been placed on injured reserve with a mild concussion. He was injured in Wednesday's game with Anaheim when Ryan Carter kneed him in the head. This is Legacy's second injury of the season. Chicago Blackhawks coach Joel Quenneville returns to Colorado tonight to face the team he coached the last three seasons. He left the Avalanche after a second-round sweep in the second round of the playoffs last year. Since he was hired in Chicago, the Blackhawks have gone 12-4-6. Two college football programs have named a new head coach today in Bowling Green, Ohio. Former Tennessee offensive coordinator Dave Clawson is in charge, and at Syracuse, the new head coach is offensive coordinator Doug Marone of the New Orleans Saints. There's a college football coaching vacancy at Army. Stan Brock was let go today just days after the Black Knights were shut out by arch-rival Navy. The score, 34-0. The struggling Chicago Bears defense came through with a strong game against an offense that had been all but unstoppable last night. They held the Saints to 60 yards under their average and intercepted quarterback Drew Brees twice in their 27-24 overtime win last night. It will be a homecoming for Derrick Rose tonight when the Bulls travel to Memphis to take on the Grizzlies. Rose led the University of Memphis Tigers with a 38-2 record last season before the Bulls chose him with the number one overall pick in this summer's draft. And the University of Illinois volleyball squad is taking on California in the regional semifinals of the NCAA volleyball tournament in State College, Pennsylvania. The Illini seeded ninth, the Golden Bears eighth. This evening, the number one seed Penn State meets Western Michigan. The winners of today's contests will meet tomorrow. That's sports.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Radio Maria Restaurant in downtown Champaign, now serving dinner and tapas nightly starting at 5 p.m., along with Friday and Saturday lunch and brunch menus. Registration is available for emails on news, menu changes, and upcoming special events.
Ever since the massive earthquake and tsunami that washed over Southeast Asia in 2004, scientists have been monitoring a fault line in the Indian Ocean. More than 200,000 people died in the last disaster. Scientists say they are worried about another catastrophe. NPR's Christopher Joyce tells us why.
Geologists don't usually predict earthquakes, but they will make qualified forecasts. And for the past 3 years, they've been saying, "Watch out. We don't know exactly where or when, but another big quake and a tsunami could happen in the Indian Ocean." Now scientists from the California Institute of Technology, working with colleagues in Indonesia, say it's coming pretty soon.
It'll probably happen in the lifetimes of children who are alive today.
Aaron Meltzner is a geologist and an author on a paper in this week's issue of the journal Science. He and his colleagues have used an unusual marker to track the history of quakes, the growth patterns of micro-atolls. These are small coral formations. They look like sombreros a few yards across. They are created when the seabed moves up and down before or during quakes. Whenever the top of the coral is pushed up out of the water and exposed to air, it stops growing up but continues to grow out, making the sombrero shape. The growth lines in these coral sombreros tell a 700-year story of the seafloor's rise and fall, punctuated with sudden quakes. And they show a cycle.
It's basically this pattern of a century or so with no earthquakes, then a cluster of moderate earthquakes that's anywhere from a few decades to nearly a century long. And every time that we have documented this, which is about four times now, it culminates with kind of the granddaddy of them all, the big magnitude 8.8 to 9.0.
The team looked at micro-atolls on islands along the Mentawai Fault. It's part of the much longer Sunda Trench that runs parallel to the island of Sumatra. A rupture in the northern section of the Sunda Trench caused the 2004 disaster. And now the Mentawai section of the fault is acting up. There was a big quake there last September. Meltzner suspects that was the start of a new quake cluster in the latest cycle. He says the Mentawai granddaddy could be on the way. And scientists who studied the fault say it still has a lot of tension in it.
So that fault, even though it just had a major earthquake, is still at a high state of stress, and it's really a ticking bomb, so to speak, on a timescale of several decades.
The government of Indonesia will be better prepared if and when the big one does come. Indonesia inaugurated its own tsunami warning system last November. Patricio Bernal heads the UN Intergovernmental Oceanic Commission. He says maps of where another tsunami might hit encouraged Indonesia to invest in the necessary equipment.
People see what portion of a given city with hospitals, schools, and all the infrastructure there will be inundated by a tsunami. So then people sort of react and say, oh, we have a problem.
Indonesia has placed three undersea detectors in the ocean to warn of a tsunami, and with other Indian Ocean countries, they've put 23 seismometers around the Indian Ocean to detect quakes. Bernal was in Indonesia during a recent earthquake and saw the warning system in action.
They issue a warning over the night, so that warning did reach the population. So I'm much more confident today that the system are slowly evolving to a point where they can be fully effective for warning the population.
Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Congress repeatedly failed to change immigration law. Now the Bush administration is trying out its own. The administration has issued revised rules designed to make it easier for farming companies to hire foreign workers. There are more than 500 pages of revised rules. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports, however, many analysts doubt the new regulations will solve the problem of undocumented migrant labor.
The Bush administration's recent immigration crackdown has posed an almost existential threat to agriculture. It's estimated some 70% of farm workers are undocumented. There's a guest worker program for these jobs called H-2A, but it's rarely used because, employers complain, it's a bureaucratic nightmare. Often as not, they say, workers arrive after harvest time, leaving crops dead on the vine. The new rules are meant to change that. There are more than 500 pages of revisions, and interest groups say they're still plowing through the details. But Bruce Goldstein of Farm Worker Justice says the changes are not good for farm laborers.
Really low wages, really low benefits, no real government oversight. So the net result would be, you know, we the government are going to allow you to exploit workers legally instead of allowing you to exploit them illegally.
Goldstein is especially upset by a change in the way growers must prove they can't find U.S. workers. Right now, the Department of Labor must certify a domestic shortage before a grower can petition for foreign labor. Under the new rules, growers themselves would attest to a shortage and send proof they tried to recruit Americans. Eric Nicholson of the National Farm Workers Union believes this could pose a temptation to replace American workers with foreign ones.
These workers do not enjoy the same real rights of speaking out, articulating complaints about the terms and conditions of their employment, because if they do, what we've seen over and over again is they face sudden firing, eviction from grower-controlled housing, and deportation.
A Labor Department official insists the new rules would actually do more to protect U.S. workers. He says growers would have to start recruiting them earlier, and those who tried to cheat would face substantially higher penalties. Growers welcome changes they say would streamline the cumbersome multi-agency guest worker program. But beyond all the nitty-gritty in the new regulations, both sides share a major complaint.
The fundamental shortcoming of any regulatory approach is that it can't get at the enormity of the crisis.
Craig Regelbrugge is with the American Nursery and Landscape Association. He says the new rules do nothing about the many undocumented farm workers already in the country who, he says, are not allowed to apply for guest worker visas.
You've got hundreds and hundreds of thousands of experienced farm workers who have the special skills, who are part of the fabric of our society, whether we want to admit it or not. It would be a devastating blow to agriculture to lose the talent pool that is currently doing the work.
Growers and labor groups want those workers here now to be legalized. Years ago, they hashed out compromise legislation to do that and say they'll keep pushing for it. The new guest worker regulations are slated to start taking effect in January, but labor advocates say they'll consider possible legal action to put them on hold. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
NPR has been reporting for months on the devastating problems facing banks. Recently, the network sent a reporter to visit a part of the country where the banking system is doing just fine, as far as is known. The most basic banking principles are still in force there. Only lend to people you know can pay you back. NPR's Adam Davidson visited the Old Order Amish community of Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
To get your head around the strange tension of Amish life, go to a buggy auction. You are in the 21st century, and you are also visiting the 1600s, all at the same time.
Here we got new carriage and wine interior. Easy ride springs, LED headlights, lots of extras, 1 year warranty. And it is ready to go.
About a dozen buggies are lined up in a muddy field. Hundreds of Amish men in a big clump follow an auctioneer with a portable loudspeaker from buggy to buggy. In a lot of ways, it's like any automobile auction. Each buggy has a big sign in the window, brand new, 2008 model. There are Amish teenage boys all around, literally kicking the tires, checking out all the new extras like the fiberglass windscreen and, no joke, retractable cup holders carved out of maple wood. I asked two guys standing by one buggy how much it would set me back.
From 7 to 8,000.
Yeah.
Starting price is going to be five or six. So. Are you thinking of buying one?
I live in New York City, so it'd be hard to get around with one. But how old are you when you usually get your first carriage?
15 to 16.
And do you work for that, or your dad will buy it?
Yeah, dad buys it.
One thing that's different from car buying is that Amish people don't take out a buggy loan. In fact, most Amish don't have much debt at all, no credit cards. They pay for everything with cash or check. Except when they buy a farm. That takes borrowing, and that means working with a banker. There are no Amish bankers, no Amish-owned banks, so Amish people use the local banks. In Lancaster County, many banks have drive-through lanes specially sized to accommodate a horse and buggy. It's a favorite tourist picture. And for the Amish, there's one banker above all others, Bill O'Brien. He's not Amish, but he's become a big part of the community, which means, among other things, that he loves telling jokes he heard from Amish customers. The problem is that people who don't spend all their time with Amish people, we don't get these jokes. Like, here's the punchline to one, which I guess is supposed to be dirty.
Well, she says, you don't get out a two-row corn picker for a little nubbin. So,
let me tell you about Bill O'Brien. This time of year, it's hard not to think of Santa Claus. He's not that big or old, but he's got a beard and laughs a lot and is just a pleasure to spend time with. He runs the Ag Lending Department for Hometown Heritage Bank. That means he's responsible for around $100 million in farm and farmhouse loans, 95% of which are to Amish people. So, how do you lend money to a man who wants to buy a farm but has no credit history, no FICO score, not even a driver's license?
I'll find out who his dad was. I'm also interested in who his wife's father is. Is she from a farm? And was her father a farmer? Because it takes a team to make a farm go.
the weird thing, or maybe it's not that weird. Bill says that the Amish are less risky than people with access to all the tools of modern banking. The Amish live well within their means, no splurging on iPods or HDTVs or dinner out that they can't afford. And the Amish think that missing a payment brings shame, not just on them, but on their whole family, their whole community.
We've never lost any money on an Amish deal. And so I'll stretch my neck a little more for them than maybe I will somewhere else.
Never lost money on an Amish loan, ever. He's been doing this 20 years. He's had countless thousands of loans and no problems. He says this year, one guy was a few days late on 1 month's mortgage payment. Everyone else paid on time, every time. Now, before every banker listening decides to quit their big city job and make low-risk loans to the Amish, you have to realize it takes a lot of work. O'Brien puts 1,000 miles on his car every week. His customers are not internet banking. He has to go and talk to them on their farms. O'Brien takes me to the top of a hill, and we can see dozens of farms below us. I ask him how many of these are his clients.
All of them.
Every house?
Every house.
There's a lot of houses.
I know. We got a lot of clients.
So who's that farm right in front?
This is Chris Real. He actually had to give Amos here permission to...
O'Brien knows every farm. He knows which are doing well, which are struggling. He has to, because when you lend to the Amish, you don't pass that loan on to some other investor. Amish loans can't be securitized. They can't be turned into a mortgage-backed security or a CDO like all of those subprime loans that have caused so much trouble. You can't for an odd legal reason. Homes that don't have electric power don't qualify for securitization. Neither do homes without traditional insurance, and Amish use their own kind of insurance.
If the guy's 7 days late, if I need to, I'll go pull his beard. I mean, we always taught in our banking that you make the loan, you collect it, you service it. If we do an Amish house, we keep them within the bank.
And it works. In this year of financial crisis, of storied old banks collapsing in hours, Hometown Heritage has had its best year ever. And with the total collapse of securitization and all those fancy financial tools, it's tempting to say, hey, when it comes to buying a house, we're all Amish now. Adam Davidson, NPR News.
Earth and Sky.
Friday, December 12, 2008. Today at 9:48 p.m. Universal Time, the moon will be closer to Earth than it's been in the last 15 years.
The moon will be less than 357,000 kilometers or 222,000 miles away. After today, the moon won't come this close to Earth for another 8 years.
Today is also the full moon, and the next time the moon comes this close, on November 14th in the year 2016, it'll be full again.
Extra close moons happen when the full moon coincides with the moon's closest point to Earth for the month.